Hey, what's up, everybody, and welcome back to the Executive Function Online Summit. I'm really glad you guys are here again. My name is Seth Perler, Seth of SethPerler.com. I'm here today with Gretchen Wegner, and she helps students. Well, she works, like I do, with students, parents, and educators because she feels like everybody needs to be working on the issues that we're dealing with here. But she really specializes in helping students. She has an approach called the anti-boring approach to studying. Is that correct? And she really takes unusual approaches to help students figure out how to study smarter, not harder, how to get more out of their studying, really, how do we learn? So, good morning. How are you?
Morning. I'm still a little bleary-eyed. I have my coffee with me. So I'm imagining we'll pep up as we go here. It's morning time. Recording this just for the watchers out there.
And today, what are we going to learn before we get into a more in-depth intro?
Yeah, I'm kind of known for my whiteboard, so I made a few for us today. But yeah, since I'm really interested in the study piece, like how do we get students to study effectively and independently, I want to talk about the relationships between executive functions and studying. I also want to look at what I'm seeing as the biggest reason that students struggle with studying in the first place. I guess that's an assumption I'm making that students struggle, but I think it's a pretty good assumption to make. You probably see that, right?
Well, for the parents who are here because they want to learn about executive function, I would guess that 99% of the parents are here because their kids struggle with school and
studying. Too.
All the students I work with do.
Yeah, totally.
100%. So.
Yeah, so we'll look at that. And then we'll talk a little bit about neuroscience because I have a model, the study cycle that we'll do next, that kind of summarizes the really complex. There's so much we know about the brain now, and you can't quite teach it all to students or even parents without overwhelming them. So I've figured out how to consolidate and teach the most important nuggets that make students take action, effective action on studying. So we'll look at both of those. And then we'll look at some routines, some time management routines that I like to call anti-boring routines that kind of help students take action more consistently with their studying.
Awesome. And I want to mention that Gretchen has a YouTube channel like I do where I use a lot of whiteboards, but not on my YouTube channel. But she makes all these quick videos giving tips about how she approaches helping kids. So check that out. Cool. I'm really excited to get into this because as we were talking in the pre-interview, this is an area that I want to be better at in terms of my coaching practice. You and I probably work with very, very similar kids, except in different parts of the country. But we really probably work with very similar kids. So I'm really excited to dive into this. Before we dive in, we'll do some background questions for 5 or 10 minutes. I want to ask you about, Gretchen, your personal background, nothing to do with professional stuff. Who are you, real quick?
Yeah. Do you know the phrase, third culture kid?
I don't.
So I think it's funny that that came up as the first thing, but I grew up overseas. And until I was in third grade, and I read an article, thank goodness for the internet and being able to I read this article about 5 years ago and I was like, oh my God, that's me. And it's like kids who grow up overseas, but identify like I was an American. I just lived in Egypt and Australia. You're kind of in the middle. You're kind of stuck in the middle between cultures. And so I've never felt like fully American, fully anything. Because I lived in a village in Egypt for several years. And so I have just this wide, it's this child, all these crazy experiences when I was younger that that helps me be the quirky person I would say I am today.
Are you familiar with the term multi-potentialite?
No.
There's a great blogger. She coined this term. But it's like sort of this idea that we don't have to have one career and one interest and that we can really, you seem like that type of person that gets into all types of hobbies and interests and learning endeavors.
And I'm having to control that, actually. It's made me a little like, ah, because there are like too many things. Like I'm needing to make my business. I know you said not business-wise, but I'm needing to make my business more like a little less crazy with all the things. But yeah, I have a little invention called the Muse Cubes. I like to swing dance. I like to do art. I like to do improv. So I'm kind of all over the place.
Cool. You seem like a 2E kid I would have worked with. So cool. And tell us about where you're at and then give us a bit about you professionally, your professional background.
So, and where I'm at geographically. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I live in Oakland, California. It's one of my favorite places on earth. I now realize the lake, actually Lake Merritt nearby, is just an amazing place to walk around all the time. And you see people, just so many different types of people walking around the lake and doing their different exercises. And anyway, I love Oakland. So what was the second question you asked?
Professional background.
Yeah.
How'd you get into all this?
Yeah. I think I want to go way back, but I'll make it quick.
Cool.
I've always been kind of and I remember one visiting professor from Nigeria called me an egghead. I've always been an egghead. And sometimes I feel a little shy that some of the anti-boring approach techniques that I teach are just things that I figured out when I was 11, 12, 13, 14, 15 to try and make school sufferable. Mm-hmm. It's a horrible word to use, but it's kind of what it is. It's like I tell students, I can't promise to make it fun, but we can at least try and make it anti-boring because you're responsible for your own boredom, not the teacher. And so you can try things that don't bore your brain. But so I was that kid who was just very creative. I remember one time I was studying in high school during dead week. I went into a classroom by myself. This was back then. We had blackboards, right? Not whiteboards. And I think it was a science class, maybe chemistry, and I just filled the blackboard with tiny little writing and tiny little pictures. And so the entire semester of chemistry was on the blackboard by the end of that study session. And I did well on the final. So I've always had this mix of being really sincere about studying and also really creative, and brought the two together. So one of my first jobs was at a educational theater company. And I like to tell people the name because I think you'll get why this planted some seeds in me. It was called CLIME Theater, and CLIME stands for Creative Learning Ideas for Mind and Body. So from the very beginning, I was interested in that. And then I realized, actually, I want to be a teacher. So I went back to school and got trained as a teacher. And then I landed in a classroom out here at a private school and realized I am no good at trying to make kids do things they don't want to do. And I wasn't passionate. I was teaching history, and I wasn't passionate enough about the subject area, because what I was passionate about was each kid figuring out the source of their own curiosity and creativity, and figuring out their own learning process. And
had you gotten a degree in teaching history?
No, I got my master's in education. I basically was like, oh, I love creating curriculum. I like sustained relationships with students, because at the theater company, I only had relationships for an hour at a time with the teachers.
You and I are very similar in so many. Part of the way that I designed my business was because I was a teacher for 12 years, but I really, I actually thought about going into therapy, becoming a therapist. And I didn't want like 1 hour a week. I wanted to really get to know my people. Like they almost felt like family. And that's happened. Like some of my clients I've had for 3, 4, 5 years. I have clients from years back that I'm still in touch with. And I really like connecting with human beings, you know, so it sounds very similar. And I like, you know, what you're saying about CLIME. Like, as I imagine you as a teacher, I imagine you in that school must feel kind of stifling, to feel like in limiting and boxed in to, and you seem like the type of person who has to really go out, be able to try things, create models, work with people in very different ways, differentiate for different minds and see them very differently. And that's probably not the
Yeah, it wasn't really possible in that setting. And I tried. And I too was not somebody who was interested in grading. I don't believe in grades exactly myself. I mean, I do believe in feedback, and sometimes numbers do provide it.
So just to give context, before we started here, we were talking about that I don't believe in letter grades. And but yeah, I agree with assessment, or like like useful information about how a child is progressing or learning or isn't, or whatever. So go ahead. I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah. And so actually I didn't get recontracted. It was a private school, so I wasn't exactly fired, but I didn't get recontracted because a new leader came in and he saw, I was this kind of explosive, creative person who needed a lot of mentoring around the parts of teaching that are more administrative and you know, not as creative. And he wasn't willing to do that, the level of mentoring I needed. And that's how I accidentally stumbled upon academic coaching. I applied for a bunch of tutoring jobs because I was just kind of desperate. And one of the tutoring jobs was called academic coaching. And in fact, it's what I'll tell the story because it's perfect for what we're talking about today. At the interview, the person who interviewed me said, "Have you heard of executive functions?" And I said, "Well, no, I haven't, but let me just make up a definition based on what I think it is." This was like 10, 12 years ago. "Based on what I think it is, given the name executive functions." And I defined it apparently very well. And she was like, "Yeah, go research it. But yeah, you kind of get what's going on here." So she hired me actually to start a school-based academic coaching program. So I went from like 0 to 20 clients immediately. And I was managing 2 or 3 other coaches. And I got to go to faculty meetings, so I got to interface between teachers and students.
And she allowed you to design the programming?
Well, I was using her model of academic coaching, but her model was just simply 8 sessions once a week for an hour with students.
But you had flexibility in terms of, because you were mentioning earlier that you like to design curriculum. Just for anybody who's watching, as people, this is mostly parents who are watching, and I just want to fill in any holes that some people may not know about. But for somebody who enjoys designing curriculum, which is, I think, what you said, I like to too, even though I don't agree with most of what's out there because it's a textbook and it's very, you know, follow our steps. But to design what I call creatively differentiated curriculum, which is just the words that I use. But so you got to, you get started, it's kind of a blessing in disguise that you didn't have your contract anymore. And then suddenly you get into this field where, wow, you can really spend some time creatively helping students.
Yeah, because part of being an academic coach is connecting deeply with the student, asking good questions, hearing their answers, and then going, "Oh, okay, I get what's going on. Let's try this now." And so the "let's try this" is like improvisatory curriculum writing. And so that brings together both of my like special skills. I'm really good at making up interesting, and actually like my best ideas are the ideas that happen when I'm just speaking. So likely, I think you might be that way too. Like I bet a lot of brilliance will just come out today because we're in conversation with each other.
Now, why do you think, because I'm guessing you're in the same situation where I am, where you see these kids and they're just, you use the anti-boring approach, they're bored to death and they're in a school and they have a teacher or a class, and we don't empower teachers to take an improvisatory, I'm not sure if I use that word right, approach. And I know why I think we wouldn't do that, but why do you think we don't see many teachers or educational approaches that allow a teacher or empower a teacher to go more with what's going on with the interests of the kids or the curiosities, or, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we could probably spend our whole hour talking.
Let's just do, I do want to get for everybody watching, we will get into some real strategies for what you can do, but.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a number. When you learn about the history of our model of education, you see that our model was built to create students who are good factory workers, who know how to respond to instructions and chain shifts when bells ring and that kind of thing. And so if that's what we're training students to do, we also need teachers are nothing but just poor middle managers, right? Who are trying to control the factory worker people. So, I mean, it's kind of sad to say that out loud, but it's like, that's the model that we...
Well, I think that's important for parents who have not heard this stuff to hear some of what you and I and a lot of people will be talking about behind closed doors. So keep going. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's one reason is school is not necessarily designed for creative thinking. School is also designed to take all of the information that's deemed important to Western, largely white culture and insert it into the minds of students so mm-hmm. that they can be productive citizens.
Right.
Productive citizens in the way the country is structured. So, right.
And we don't think about this because it sounds like some conspiracy theory and all that, but somebody is writing the textbook, somebody's designing the curriculum. Who are the powers that be? And why do, for example, why don't kids learn anything about money and how to manage money, you know?
Oh my God, wouldn't that just be so incredible?
Yeah. But so there are hierarchies in our culture, and the powers that be don't necessarily. Okay, I'm not going to get too into.
So those are a couple, because you asked specifically about teachers, and so, but I know that so many teachers, and I was this way. I'm sure you were this way. All the teachers who come through my trainings are this way. They're highly creative people, and they want to do a good job. So they've inherited this kind of limiting structure, and also we're overwhelmed with too many kids in the classroom. Kids don't really want to be there, so they're either compliant, like they're pretty numbed out, and either they're compliant or they're not compliant with the rules, but either of that comes from a nervous system that's kind of in a like the fight, flight, or freeze state. So we don't really have a situation that helps people be relaxed, happy learners in elementary school, I think more than middle and high school. So there's just so many complexities that come into people feeling hemmed in and like they can't be their fullest selves in the classroom, and you can't be creative and improvisatory, to use my word, if you're not comfortable being your fullest self. And gosh, do our kids with learning differences know what it's like to not feel like you can be your full self. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, we're back to it. I had to pause for a second there. Cool. So I'm really glad that we had this little talk. If you want to finish, if I interrupted or you want to finish up on that, go ahead. But I don't think I've gone there with anybody who I've spoken to on the summit yet. And you and I could probably talk about this forever. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole anymore. But what I do want parents to know who are watching this is that we shouldn't just accept the way things are. And maybe Gretchen and I have viewpoints that you don't agree with or haven't thought about or have thought of, whatever, but definitely parents, explore these issues and question things, especially parents when something doesn't feel right. I think a lot of times parents are also influenced by the system or the powers that be to be quiet. Don't be a helicopter parent, you know, trust us. We've got, if something doesn't feel right, explore the heck out of that and really go down that rabbit hole and be tenacious and advocate for that kid and be the squeaky wheel and really listen to your gut and, you know, consider how you approach communicating about those things, because you want to get the objective, which is to get your kid the services they need. But so how can you best communicate what you need to communicate, but do listen to your gut and explore when you feel that. Don't ignore that. Is that fair to say?
I love that. Yeah. And the way that I would articulate that just a little bit differently, but it's the same thing, is listen to your body. Like in so many ways, schools are anti-body. Mm-hmm. You know, sit still, don't move. And kids, especially the kiddos that we work with, are so in their bodies, often in a painful way. Like I was just talking to a client yesterday who now he's in college, and when he was in sixth grade, he was like, it's just like fire under my skin, Gretchen. That's what ADHD feels like to him. And so, yeah, parents, when you have a feeling in your body that says, something's not right. Do pursue it. Don't just assume that all the placating administrators out there are necessarily right if you're not feeling right about it.
Because they, not everybody does get it and does understand what's going on. And you know, we have, and teachers or administrators, you know, we're human beings. They may have grown up with their own dysfunction, their own ideas about the world and their own ideas about education. And it may not be right or right for you or for your kid. Cool. I don't want to get distracted, but I think what you said is so important. And this is coming up in almost every single talk with the body. So I'm going to, we're not even into the meat of this yet, but I am going to get off track here because I think it's so important. So you said, I want to say it's in the body. And you said in our schools, we do not really honor or empower kids to really explore, articulate. When you said the kid with ADD said it feels like his on fire under his skin or whatever the word you used, most of us would kind of let that comment go. But I think it's really important to say he's communicating something really important. And by the time we're adults, so I'm thinking of the parents watching this, probably a lot of the parents watching this, we are very disconnected as adults from our bodies and are probably like, what the heck are you talking about, Gretchen and Seth? What do you mean my body? You know, because our culture, we are very disconnected. Yeah. And I have spent 15 or so years like learning that it and getting into meditation and mindfulness and yoga and starting to feel what's going on to a level I never even knew existed.
No,
because I never grew up with that. And then there are probably parents who have gone down that rabbit hole and understand this. So tell us a little bit more about why that was so important for you to say and how, what might parents leave this, you know, at least the next couple minutes of this conversation with, what do you wish they knew or started knowing about this?
Yeah, gosh. What's the short thing? So when I got my master's in education, I've always created my own major in undergrad and grad school and everything. And so I wrote about three different kinds of inquiry. I wrote about critical inquiry, because that's like very important, right? And then I wrote about spirit-centered inquiry, which I think we don't allow students
to talk about it in school.
Yeah. And then I talked about body-based inquiry. And I was like, what would schooling look like? At the time, I didn't know about coaching. And that, now I would say those three are very wrapped up in the work that I do with students. But what would classrooms be like if we allowed ourselves to inquire with all of these parts of ourselves? And it's what makes our students with ADHD so precious, is that they, although they're not conscious of the body-based inquiry, like their body is telling them things all the time about what's right and what's wrong. And rather than telling them like your body is wrong, what if we listen to that? So maybe I'll just tell a quick client story because it might be useful for the parents. Another student with ADHD, she hates reading. I'm sure you've seen that, right? And she says, I can tell it's a good book. They're reading The Outsiders this summer. I can tell it's good, but my legs feel itchy, she said. My legs just feel itchy. So we've been doing, so I did some research. That's just what I do. And it's like, what are some ways to read where you can move your body? And I got all kinds of ideas. And so she's now got a yoga ball in her room, and she's going to sit and bounce on the yoga ball while she's reading, or kick the ball against a wall, or you know, you can even like be on a trampoline and read if you want to, or sit on the trampoline and kind of bounce your butt a little bit. And it's like, when we don't say that's something that's wrong about you, whatever the body is saying is wrong, but actually let's actually get curious and see, let's inquire into what the body is saying it needs, so that we're not trying to turn you into one of the compliant kids who sit quietly. Right. We're trying to help you figure out how your system can interact with the world.
Awesome. I'm standing right now.
Are you?
On all these interviews. I have a bouncy chair with a spring on it. This one wobbles like that. It's not a fit ball, but I use the fit balls in the office a lot. I remember my first student, he was a fifth grader. I was teaching fifth grade at the time, and he was one of the, he had so much trouble sitting still. And I remember this was the first time when I really pulled someone aside and I'm like, okay, here's what I'm going to let you do. I'm going to let you walk around. You have to be in the back of the classroom if I'm teaching. And you, as long as you are actually somewhat engaged, cool. Yeah. And it worked. And that was sort of one of the first experiences where I had, because I had to start questioning the system and all these things. And as I'm starting to learn about 2E kids and complicated needs and stuff. And one of the things that I do a lot, actually, when a kid will say to me, and I'll say this now because I think some parents can use this. If a kid says, I hate math, I say, awesome. So let's stop right there. What do you mean? Where is hate in your body? What does it feel like to hate math? Because when we're exploring that and then they can get a sense of, okay, now I'm emotionally safe, then it's not actually, I don't find that kids actually hate reading or hate math. They hate how they feel.
They feel, exactly.
When they're engaging in this activity that's considered math. Now, it may be busy work and they don't like feeling stifled, or they don't like feeling like they have to do something where they don't know how to do it, or they don't like feeling distracted if they're trying to read. But we have to really dive into what do you mean hate? That's a very strong word. So let's explore that. So thank you for saying that.
And I love you pointing out it's a strong word and it's embodied. Emotions are in our bodies. And so I love that you take time to explore where that is and help them. It's fine to hate things. Mm-hmm. I hated school all the time too.
Yeah. And it's, what do we do about that? And one thing that I'll do a lot is I'll notice, you just moved the pillow on the back of your chair.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you're saying that you'll notice what's happening with the
I was just giving you wait time to see what you would say. But yeah, I'll notice what's going on. So we'll be diving into, let's say, writing an essay or whatever the schoolwork is. And I'll notice something in their body language, like the shoulders going up or the face changing or scrunching. And I'll just point out, I notice you're doing this. And then I pause, like I just did with you. But I said, I noticed you moved the pillow behind you. And you could have said, oh yeah, it's just uncomfortable. Or, oh yeah, this helps me feel more relaxed. But what I'm saying really is that I notice what's going on, because when I reflect that to them, they start to have greater body awareness, but it also opens up. We haven't even gotten into what you're teaching today, but it opens up conversation about the deeper level. And so much of what I talk about in my practice is we always look at the tip of the iceberg. You're getting D's and F's. You're not turning stuff in. You're not trying. You're not motivated. You know, it's what's beneath the iceberg that's the magic. That's where we can really find useful information to really help a kid out. So I'm doing a lot of that reflecting, and I'm pointing that out too, because parents can do, it's such an easy one to say, instead of saying, you need to get started. Why aren't you starting? Put your name on it, you know, in the homework battles to be like, wow, you look kind of stressed. Oh, your shoulders look tense. Yeah. Wow. Your face looks kind of angry.
And that's body-based inquiry, right? Like, what's going on? I'm starting with your body. What's going on?
Now, as far as the spiritual inquiry, totally something I never talk about, but I've been thinking about making a YouTube video for a long time called The Spiritual Side of Teaching, because my teaching was a spiritual act of service to humanity. That's how I looked at it. I don't think I've ever said that publicly, but
I feel honored.
Hello, everybody. That's my first message to you. Like, I do consider my life's work a spiritual, my mission, my work. Have you heard of Indigo Kids?
I have, but I, in this moment, I'm not remembering what it's
about. When you said spiritual inquiry, that just reminded me of Indigo Kids would be kids that are possibly highly intuitive, that maybe see angels or things like that. So something else for me, to explore.
Spirit-centered inquiry in the context of education, because I don't want to, you know, it's hard, right, to get to, it's vulnerable personally, but also hard in the culture to get to into religion and or spirituality. But for me, it's like, where is the source of meaning in life coming from? Is it coming from just being a good kid and following your parents' instructions? Is it coming, you know, like, where is meaning? And how can we have
what these is this
conversations?
Say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like the heart. Spirit-centered.
Yeah, and I don't want to get into religious discussions either, but as far as spirituality, when we can define it in like a term like that, meaning, or something else that everybody understands, love. This is an act of love. Yeah. And we don't say that much, but teachers are doing, for example, what they do because they love kids, or at least they start out. You know, we have teachers who get burnt out and stuff, but they love education. They love humanity. They love people, you know, and parents love their kids. They love their families. They love their people. So, but we don't, you know, and that's the basis of every religion is love. Anyhow, this has become.
We didn't know we were going to go here, but
we for everyone
here, Seth asks each of us beforehand, like, what would make this a great, like an especially meaningful conversation? I said, I'd like to connect and learn. And here we are connecting and learning. So should we talk about studying?
Let's reel it in. All right. This is still the pre-questions, but they're more linear and direct. So how do you help students and families specifically? What's your superpower as far as kids who struggle with executive function? What's your superpower? How do you help families?
Well, one of my superpowers is just kids realize that, oh, this lady is fun. This lady is fun, and this lady will tell me the truth, and not try and pretend like that. I say that I can't make school fun for you. Sorry, that's not what our work is going to be about. But we can have fun together, and I can teach you how some tools for not being boring. So my other superpower, which works with the students and also with the educators, is I appear to be really skilled at taking a lot of complex information and condensing it down into a very concrete, easy to understand visual image that then, because you have it as a concrete concept, you can take action on it. So in my work with kids, a lot of it is, just listening at the beginning to hear what's going on. And then collecting all that complex data and then narrowing it down and going, okay, I see the habit that might be kind of your fulcrum habit. Let's work on this thing first and see how that might shift everything else or not. And then move on from there.
Meaning so that they can, what did you say? Fulcrum what?
Fulcrum habit. Like what's the habit that's in the middle that might affect?
That everything? Might tip it so that they can navigate school more effectively. Yeah. And then how do you define executive function in one sentence, and then you can explain it, but give us your one sentence and then tell us, unpack it a little bit.
Yeah, I think executive functions are about being able to step outside of yourself and see something. I've never said it that way before. Like you step outside of yourself and you see yourself, that's metacognition, or you step outside of yourself and you see the future. Mm-hmm. And so you're able to plan accordingly. So you're able, to just have that one step removed so you can see more of what's happening.
Nice. I like that. So there's a guy on the summit. He talks all about self-regulation. That's his word. This sounds, I mean, we're all saying the same thing, but you're taking it from the metacognitive stance. So being able to remove yourself, because what happens when we are not executing well is we are not self-aware, we're not metacognitive, we're not introspective, we're not self-reflective, we're not conscious of what we're doing, we're not mindful of what we're doing. We're just automatically responding and reacting to whatever the situation is. But if we can stop, we can actually think. And when you said future, to get away from our more woo-woo part of the conversation earlier, she's not saying see the future like that, but be able to imagine your future goal, where you're trying to get to finish a paper, to finish a class.
Study for a test.
Mm-hmm. Study for a test, okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. And I think you unpacked that a little bit as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so if we're still in the intro, I don't want to jump ahead, but I do have a whiteboard where I listed sort of the chunks of executive.
Let's do it. This is the time. Perfect.
Okay. Because the first thing I said we would be looking at is how does studying relate to executive function? Because some people are like, I need help with time management. like it's executive function, not studying. But it's like, but so here is, I mean, there's so many different ways to name the executive functions, mm-hmm. the executive skills, right? So
can I unpack that real quick? So what she's saying is there are experts who will say there are 3 executive functions, some that'll say 5, some that'll say 8. I just made a course where I listed 10, but there I actually will refer to 20 to 30. Yeah. Like I might say impulsivity, I might say inhibition. Those are 2 sides of the same coin. I might say them together anyhow. So just to set that stage before you get into how you listed them.
Yeah. So this list that you're seeing here is from the training that I do for educators. But I just wanted to point out quickly that learning how to manage time, that's an executive. I like to say skill rather than function because I don't know, the word skill is like, oh yeah, I want a skill. Mm-hmm. So, if you're going to learn how to study, like studying over time in little bit of chunks is proven to be more effective than cramming before the test, right? So you have to manage time well if you're going to study well. Organizing your things. Like if you've lost all your papers and don't have access to the old quizzes to study from, then you're not going to be able to study well. So organization is so much a part of studying. Planning and prioritizing. So looking ahead, the test is in 5 days. I'm probably not going to get the study guide because teachers don't give them early enough until like 2 days before, but I could start studying earlier. How am I going to write in my planner the different things that I need to do that are effective? I'm not going to walk through all of these here because we don't need to do that. But I think people get the idea, or even like you mentioned the impulsivity. That's this one, right? Yeah. Like, oh, I should study. Oh, but I'd rather watch YouTube. Studying is hard. So what are some tools and tricks to set up your studying so that you are able to better inhibit your impulses when they come up? Every single executive function is intimately connected with the act of studying and preparing for tests.
Yep, they're all related. Can you go through the rest of your list?
Oh, yes, but I threw it on the floor.
I love it. No, I want you to go through it. This is fantastic.
Okay. Yeah.
You got so, managing time, organizing, planning, and prioritizing.
Mm-hmm. And then
you put those 2 together.
Planning and prioritizing. I did it just because in the model that I was teaching, I needed to do a few every week. And so I needed to break it down into mm-hmm. kind of like you said, sometimes it's easier to clump.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This one I can't read backwards.
Working memory.
Assessing your working memory. Oh my goodness, working memory is so important in studying because I don't know if people know what working memory refers to. But the quick version is like I like to draw 3 little bubbles when I do this. Like there's long-term memory, that bubble, short-term memory, and then working memory is like if you're solving a math problem, 2 + 3 + 4 equals what? Then you're using your working memory. You're holding those numbers right now and using them to do something with them.
You're working on something, you just it's just like temporary storage.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good phrase, temporary storage for the information. And so studying, that's what you're doing. You're either learning for kids. Many of our kids with learning differences struggle with working memory. So one of the things you have to learn how to do when you're studying is how to use paper as your working memory and how to take better notes so that you're getting it out of your head and onto your paper and then manipulating it that way rather than manipulating it like in your mind.
How do you know if your kid struggles with working memory?
I always have my students always have the neuropsych report. So, so that's always what I see. So I have the clue ahead of time. But what would you say? What's a clue if you don't have a neuropsych that working memory is hard?
One that I see a lot. Well, one that I see a lot is just plain forgetfulness.
Yeah.
So, you know, hey, can you go grab this, this, and this? And the child may forget 1, 2, or all 3 of the things. Another I see a lot with middle school students or middle or high school students, but middle school students often that are good at math, they used to be able to use their working memory well enough with math to track things. Then they don't want to write their work and show their work. You said using paper as working memory. That's brilliant. But they don't want to show all their work. So they miss in their working memory, Yes. As they're juggling the math stuff, they miss one detail. The whole answer is wrong. And some teachers give credit for work. Some won't. If they don't show their work and they miscalculated one thing in their working memory or multiple things, yeah, then that's going to be wrong. So that's a way that I see it sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Yeah. I saw it with my 11-year-old nephew who was just visiting me for 10 days. You know, and some of this is learning differences, and some of this is just kids. Kids are human beings who have executive dysfunction, period.
Like, that's, yeah, just, and they're distracted.
Yeah. And so I would say, hey, Sebastian, can you take out the trash? And can you do this? And can you do that? And he might remember the first one, but definitely not the other. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, cool.
Yeah. So initiating tasks is the next one, like getting started. This is like one of the single biggest issues I work on with all my clients. Is how do
that's
you
where home? I talk about resistance a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
So in other words, procrastination.
Yes. Right. And I, you know, cause I like using anti-boring. So anti-procrastination tools. What are some tools that help you initiate tasks? And then once you've successfully initiated, thank God, how do you sustain your attention so that you don't waste the beautiful, the beautiful effort that you put into initiating?
How do you keep going? How do you follow through?
Yeah. And especially when studying, because studying is so vulnerable because it reveals to you what you know and what you don't know. And then when you see what you don't know, you have all these thoughts coming in. I'm stupid. I'm dumb. This is going to take too long. I'm going to make an F. I'm going to disappoint my family. Da, 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 da. So when you're studying, kids can receive that onslaught. And how do you persist even in the face of that extreme vulnerability and that extreme negative self-talk? So that's like a toolkit in and of itself that mm-hmm. so many students.
And can I mention too, that negative self-talk, that inner critic, as that goes off, we are having the embodied experience. We are feeling something in our body that is...
For me, my cheeks get red. I feel the pang in my stomach.
So our kids are having, you know, I often say school is an emotional experience. They are having these feelings going Absolutely. On.
And then think about a classroom of, like when I was a classroom teacher at a public school and I had 150 students coming through my day, and then bodies receive the experience of other bodies, whether we like it or not. And I was exhausted at the end of the day, partially because I was like, I have 150 different like emotional
nervous systems
coming through my classroom.
Yeah. Our nervous systems are co-regulating and bouncing off. Yeah.
Terrible. So sustaining attention and focus, and then completing tasks and persisting towards goals. Those could be seen as separate executive functions, but again, I put them together here also because I was running out of room, as you can see.
I break it up like that too.
Yeah.
Self-starting, task persistence, and then task completion. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then these last three that I lost, or four actually, 1, 2, 3, 4 that I lost space around, these are more of the metacognition, understanding yourself. So understanding self, controlling your emotions, learning how to be flexible, and then inhibiting your impulses.
I haven't heard anyone talk about the flexibility, so why don't you mention that one real quick?
Yeah, so a lot of my students will say, I don't want a plan because I know I'm not going to follow the plan, and then I'm going to hate myself. And it's like, well, plan, and I say this so much, plans are meant to be made, but not necessarily followed.
I say the same thing. You got to make the plan. You don't even necessarily have to do it. Yep.
Yeah, because when you're making the plan, you're rehearsing something. You're creating a set of pathways in your brain for what's about to happen. And then if some kids do, some of the very sincere students who are like overly perfectionists do then try to execute exactly the plan that was made, but then they're not being in the present moment because we make the plan and then life happens. And so we have to learn how to move with, oh, I have to go to grandma's tonight for dinner. Well, I thought I was going to, my plan was to do X, Y, and Z flashcards or whatever. So you have to kind of learn how to work with that. And it's hard for me as a grown-up to be flexible sometimes.
So the skill of flexibility can be developed, especially when you metacognitively learn about it and start to talk about it. And
yeah. And that's one thing coaches do, right? So it's like, so we made the plan. And then the next question usually is, what could go wrong? with the plan. And so we start rehearsing a few different possible flexible options if the plan doesn't go well. And of course, we can't know for sure what the options will be because we don't know what the future will bring. But that's how we're practicing flexibility in our coaching sessions.
All right. And then the next one is when you're working with a family or when you're working with a student who struggles with executive function, what's your A to B? In other words, the student starts working with you. The family comes to you, they say, hey, Gretchen, we are struggling with this. And then you get to a point B where the family is like, thank you so much. We're in a different place. And you're like, yeah, good. You guys don't need me anymore. Awesome. Move on. How do you describe those two places?
Yeah, I think it's actually, I'll answer that. And I want to say first that some students will always need some kind of coaching or intervention or some kind of team. Many of our kids, especially like this young man who I've been seeing off and on since he was in sixth grade with ADHD, he is always going to need some kind of external mentorship and support.
I still struggle. I legitimately struggle. And yeah. I've learned to compensate, but yeah.
Yeah. So I just want to name that so families don't feel bad. Don't think bad. That there's
an end point. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank and I'm not saying that because it's like, I make money off of continuing to, I like to graduate people away from me. And if they stay with me too long and still need coaching, then it's like, well, let's get a different mind in to work with you because I think I may have, like, it'll just be nicer for you.
Yeah.
You've heard everything I have to say.
So then in terms of like when they've, you know, when they've moved the needle and it's significantly different, what's that look like?
Yeah. So, there are two different types of students. There's the one type who just doesn't know how to study. And they're just like, I study so hard and I'm still making D's or C's or B's, whatever the bad grade is for them on tests. And they're an easier group to work with because it's like they don't necessarily have a lot of executive dysfunction. They just haven't been taught how to study because let's face it, we don't teach this skill to students. And so that A to B is I teach them a toolbox. Like I walk them through my online course. And then we, in our sessions, they do that outside our sessions. In our sessions, we practice the tools that they think will be helpful. I like to have this image of the toolbox. And I you know, because I like to have images, I have a toolbox here and it's just got regular tools. But my idea is when you work with me, you will go from having just one or two little tools in your toolbox to having an overflowing toolbox so that you always know, like in a moment, you can troubleshoot for yourself and go, right. Oh, the tool I was using isn't, the planner's not working anymore. What's a new tool I could use? And the study cycle that we're about to learn is kind of the main tool in there. So that's why I always have that.
I use that metaphor myself. When people sign up for my list, they send out a toolkit, but it's exactly as you say, like you have to know how to use these tools and we can get better and better and better, but kids don't even know that there's a toolbox. They're just randomly doing stuff that seems to look like studying.
Yes, exactly. And so for some the students who come to me with some kind of an extreme diagnosis, they won't actually get a full toolbox right away because that's another developmental level for them. They might need to understand that there is a tool and that you can use it. And let's just practice using that one tool, whatever it might be, the planner or setting reminders or, you know, whatever. So when I'm working with that kind of family, we just sort of slow way down. And sometimes for a semester, all I'm doing is helping triage in the moment so that I can understand them better before I ever help build some consciousness around what the tools are.
Okay. Yeah. And triage is what, drives where I start my coaching process usually.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. So then that student gets to point B and that point B is like, they've got a toolbox. They can use it fairly well.
Yeah, eventually.
And then what's type two?
Oh, well, so the first student is just needs the studying and then they get the toolbox and they can use it pretty well. The type two is the student who comes in with a lot of executive skill deficits and is just like, life feels chaotic to the student and the family. And that's where we're in triage together. And that's where usually, you know, the stages of competency is actually, maybe that's the best answer. How do we move from A to B? It's like, first the student needs to become, many students don't actually realize where their incompetencies are, right? They just know life sucks. And so we have to help bring awareness. Like,
oh. That's the DKDK.
Yes.
They don't know.
Yes.
Is that, I don't know if that's stages of competency model or not, but DKDK is they don't know that they don't know something. And Gretchen is saying that we have to even get them to understand that there's a problem. Then you can start to get willingness to work on the problem, et cetera.
Right. Right. And many families want to come in like, I want to see the grades better and we need to get work turned in. And it's like, well,
you're so they're looking at the tip of the iceberg.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And your student actually may not yet make the connection that they're missing work, that they have a lot of missing work. They just see each one individually, but they may not see the patterns yet, and they may not see the connection between the patterns and the low grades. And so it might take a full semester of me collecting data with them and me being a quiet nervous system, because you, parent, probably have a freaked out nervous system. And so your kid can't even hear you when you're pointing those patterns out to them. So I kind of help them see the patterns. And so that might be all we'll do in a semester is get to the point where the kid goes, oh, this really is a problem. Next semester, I want to really work on turning work in.
And I think that goes back to what you said earlier about, you know, some people will be working on this for years or for the rest of their life. Like, and what is progress? And I think that, parents often want to see progress in these tangible ways that we've sort of been indoctrinated into looking at, but that you really have to look at progress in other ways and say, wow, the fact that the kid knows and cares can be a massive progress for a lot of kids.
Huge, huge. Yes.
So you got to really step back. We have to step back as adults and say, what are we actually trying to accomplish here? It may not be the tip of the iceberg and what we think, right. Maybe other things. So that ties right into what are some of the blind spots that you see for families that are coming to you? What is their DKDK?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the biggest blind spot is on the side of the parents. Sorry, parents.
Well, that's who's watching. So they're here because they want to learn.
Yeah. And I think, so I heard myself saying at a talk recently, I was like, and so maybe this might be the most important thing that a parent, like it may be more important than the study cycle, what I'm about to say, is that every parent needs at least three ways to self-soothe and to calm their anxiety that don't include their child's behavior changing. And so I see a lot of families wanting to do coaching. Of course, they want it for their kids. They love their kid. They want the grades better. And what they're not really naming is, I'm so anxious. I need my kid's behavior to change so that my life doesn't have to be so anxious. And if that's happening, like, I'm happy to work with your kid and to support your kid, and I really need you to do the emotional work that you can do to calm your own anxiety, because your kid is like a sponge, sucking in your anxiety about their future. And they're not going to be able to grow as fast in my work if you don't have three things you can do on a daily or weekly basis to calm your own anxiety that don't include their behavior changing.
I like that you put the number three on it. It doesn't matter if it's three or 10 or 50, but just to put a structure around, look, be consciously working on some of these things. And I'll throw out what some of my things could be, because I talk about that as adults, we need to be doing our own deep inner work. We mirror to our kids. We speak nervous system to nervous system. They're vibing off of us. And when we mirror, when we model, that we are care enough about ourselves to do our own work on ourselves too, without even telling them, they see that, they feel it, they learn it. They learn from us that is important, and that's what an adult does. And they can journal, they can read self-development books, they can go to therapy themselves, they can go to self-help groups, they can go to Facebook groups, they can meditate. What are some that you
Well, just more body ones. You can go work out, you can, oh my goodness, go, what are the take a tree bath, is that the Japanese word phrase for it? Like, go be in nature. get into your breath, like 20 minutes of cardiovascular can do amazing things to change your chemicals inside you.
Cool. I've been doing a lot of breath work lately, Wim Hof and two-stage breath work. If anybody wants to look that up, it's been amazing for me. Awesome. So that was one of the big blind spots. And then I'm going to ask about it because I do want to get into the study cycle, and we may go longer on this one if that's okay with you, but this is such a nice foundation getting to that point. What blocks, well, this might be the same answer. What blocks kids from being able to move forward? What's one of the biggest blocks you see that holds them back?
Oh, since I already mentioned that to the parents, maybe saying that it's the same answer, but for the kids. More and more, like, I'm not a trained life coach. I'm a trained teacher. You know, I moved into academic coaching. I put the word life into academic life coaching for myself because I wanted parents to see we're going to handle more than just grades. And I am seeing just more and more and more that even though I feel rushed, and I feel rushed by the parents to like work on whatever the missing work is and all of that, that I need to slow down and help these students find tools to manage their own anxiety. And whenever I share, this is not one of the models we'll be able to talk today, but this is my time management gears that I talk about with students, and each gear represents, it's sort of a checklist that they can use. And the last gear is self-talk. You need tools for self-talk. And whenever I ask students after I share this model with them, I say, which gear is the gear that gets in your way the most? And every student says self-talk. And so
the mindset.
Yeah.
Existence.
Yeah.
I'm stupid. I hate this.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I have a couple like quick tools that I teach them, and a lot of them don't even necessarily use the tools regularly. But one student told me just a few weeks ago, she said, you know, I was less anxious during final exams because I knew there was a tool I could turn to if my brain started freaking out.
So what's one of those that's really concrete that people can learn right this second?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I could teach it right this second.
Okay.
Easy access.
Well, that's okay.
Yeah.
Cause we're going to get into the study cycle.
Yeah. Yeah. So, self-talk is one of the, you could do a whole summit next year. It could be like, how do we help kids handle their stressful thoughts and their stressful feelings?
Yeah. So, and then what is a common misunderstanding? And I think you've alluded to this too, but what's one of the most common misunderstandings that parents have?
Oh, that parents specifically have?
So parents watching right now, they want to help their kid with executive function. What's one of the big misunderstandings that you always hear parents come in with?
Well, I'll keep it to studying, since I know we're going to be moving soon to the study cycle, but it's that, how do I articulate? It's like they assume that, oh, but I've shared, like I told my kid how I studied, like flashcards, or like this idea that knowing one or two strategies means you know how to study, and they're not following through with the strategies I gave them. So something's wrong. And it's actually knowing how to study is actually not about strategies. I mean, yes, we want a lot of strategies, but if you don't know how to use the strategies smartly, you can use a strategy well, or you can use a strategy not so well. And so the real importance, actually, I would say, of teaching brain theory to students and giving them a roadmap for this body and brain of ours by actually teaching a little bit of brain science is really important. And I don't think parents realize that coming in.
This has been a fantastic foundation. Thank you so much. Now let's get into, what do we do with all this information?
Get into it. Okay, let me look at my list to see if there's anything, because I think maybe we should just dive into. Yeah, well, so, okay. So this is, I don't know if you've read this book, Seth. It's an older book by now, Make It Stick, The Science of Successful Learning. There are many others now.
Like, who wrote that?
This is Brown, Roediger, and McDaniel, and these are some professors who actually mentored the learning scientists who you may know, They have a podcast all about the brain and learning as well. And when you look at all these things, it's like, it's so good. There's so much great information here about how the brain works, but it's overwhelming and it's not actionable at all. And
that's what I find with a lot of the executive function stuff in particular. And that's why I want the summit too, is a lot of it's not, it is overwhelming. And it's like, what do we do? And that's why this part of the session is, what do we do? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I like to teach families, and I give this talk at schools around the Bay Area. I like to teach that all like those books that I showed, the three most important things you need to know about how the brain learns. And that's awesome. What I've summarized in the study cycle. So shall we learn those right now?
Let's do it. I love, me too. I love models, but I've immersed myself in so many that I can see what themes work for me and communicate that. Yep. Let's do this. Yeah. I'm excited. Yeah.
So I wasn't as good an artist as I sometimes am when I draw, because you and I were chatting while I was trying to draw these. But so this down here is my attempt at drawing a basket. I don't yet have a better metaphor than a basket, but if somebody thinks of one, I'd love to hear it. So this is like everything. The basket is filled with all the facts and all the skills you need to demonstrate you have mastery over when you take the test. So just imagine it with like filled with all these facts you need to know. So the first step in learning is we need to get the information from outside of us, from the textbook or from the teacher's brain or from wherever, and we need to get it into our brain. So this is the learner. I've revealed the learner's brain so that we really get like it's coming into the brain. This is step one of three. And this is just the initial learning. So I put, you know, you can put the word learning here. If I'm making it really simple for students, I just put the word in, like we got to get the information in our brain. And sometimes I even make them do the gesture, because when we use our bodies, we remember things more.
So no matter what subject it is, somehow we have to take this thing that's metaphorically outside of us and get it in here.
Exactly.
First.
Exactly. Okay. And the word, the brain science word that I introduce students to, that I always like to use the brain science so that they get that this is a real thing, is encoding. So we have to turn this information into some kind of code in our brains. We have to build our initial neural pathways for the information.
So that when, the neurons, the brain cells are making connections, which means that it's starting to stick.
Yeah, right. And it may not fully stick yet, but something sticks. And so I'll talk about with students, if we're working on a specific test, I'll say, how did you learn the, like, does your teacher lecture first, or does your teacher assign you to read the textbook first? Like, what is your first interaction with the material? And that's the encoding.
So what is the first thing that, is pouring out of the first way that the bucket is pouring out into your head? Okay, cool.
Yes.
Can I mention a little hack I have here a lot?
Yeah.
For kids who are willing to be proactive. Now I'm dealing with resistant kids, but one of the best things that kids who, one of the best things is before they dive into a unit of study is to get on YouTube and watch a documentary or an awesome, passionate YouTuber about the subject they're about to dive into, because then you have a little foundation. Then when the teacher starts pouring their bucket, it's encoding onto something that's already.
Exactly. Actually, then it'll be, let's try to remember to come back to that, because after I show the whole cycle, then I'd love to remember to ask you, if you watch your YouTubes first so that you're actually encoding it yourself, then where are you on the study cycle when your teacher is teaching you? So, but let me share the other pieces first. So we encode, and a lot of students stop right there. All they ever do is encode, encode, encode. So they reread their notes. They reread the textbook. It's so boring, right? But it's all they're doing. But there are two more stages that they're missing out on that makes for more efficient and also effective learning. So stage two is on the second side. Do you have any guesses, Seth, for what it might be?
Connection?
Like the connection of the ideas?
Yeah, connecting what you've encoded to something that's more meaningful or something that you already know.
Yeah, that might actually be step three.
Okay.
So, but that's lovely. And I always love to ask students to make a guess, because sometimes I learn too. So step two is once we've encoded, then we need to actually test ourselves to see what got encoded, what stuck, what didn't. And all the science shows that what people call retrieval practice is the best study strategy ever. So rereading is not as effective as testing yourself to see what you know and what you don't know. So I like to use the word test here because kids know what a test is. I like to use the word out as the simple word because like before you were pouring it in and then it's like peering in and seeing like if we're thinking of water, like were there holes in the bottom? Like did some water drip out? What water what stayed, what didn't? That's what you're testing yourself here. And in education, usually teachers are responsible for testing you. But the smart student gets that I'm responsible for testing myself repeatedly in lots of small ways. And the more I take that responsibility away from the teacher and I claim it for myself, the better I will be able to learn. So, and retrieval or retrieve, that's the fancy brain term there. So when we retrieve, we find out two things. Either I know it or I don't. So if I'm just going to use flashcards as an example. If I retrieve by going through flashcards, then I find out, oh yeah, I kind of knew that vocabulary word or I don't. If I know it, great. That fact or that word can leave the study cycle for right now, not forever, but for the present moment. If I don't know it, it goes back into the basket, and the basket is now all the things that are going to be on the test that I still don't know well. So then there's
all the things that leaked out of the bottom of the bucket.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. So, and there's nothing wrong with you that things leaked out. That's the learning process, because what we need is we need to do the third thing. And the third thing is over on the encoding side again. So then everything that's still in the bucket, we need to encode, but here's the rub. We need to do it in a new way. So not by rereading the textbook again, but in a new, different way, because we're trying to not be bored with our learning and we're trying to not expect our teachers. It's wonderful. If our teachers are creative curriculum designers and come up with all kinds of fun ways for us to learn, yay. They're helping us do the study cycle. We don't have to think about it. That's fun. But you actually can be responsible for having a full toolkit of ways to encode things differently. And when I ask students after I teach them this, I say, which step is your strength and which step is your weakness in regards to how many tools you have? And what would you say, Seth, for yourself, where on the study cycle is your strength and weakness?
Probably three. I like to immerse myself in a lot of different ways of doing something. Mm-hmm. I like mm-hmm. to so ask that would, people, right. talk about it, read about it, watch videos about it, see where it shows up in everyday life. So maybe three.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And so the resistant student that you talked about before, who you say, like, normally the teacher's going to lecture about it first, step one. But if they actually watch a YouTube video about it first so that they've encoded something, so they've taken responsibility for step one on the study cycle, then where are they on the study cycle when the teacher's lecturing when they go to class?
Probably a combination of two and three.
Exactly. If you are being mindful, so because this is where metacognition comes in and learning how to, like, I as a student get to choose where I am on the study cycle in any given moment. So when I come to class, I could say, gosh, it'd be fun to listen to the lecture and test myself and see if I can guess what the professors or the teacher is about to say before mm-hmm. they say it. If I do that, then I'm practicing retrieval. When I guess, and then the professor says something different than I thought they would say, ooh, that just got encoded in a new way.
Mm-hmm.
I heard it not just from the YouTube video, but I heard it in a classroom environment, you know, being spoken rather than visual. So it is possible for all these things to be happening at once, but it's also possible, and the more advanced students can start making choices for how they do these steps at once. But the students who can't hold that complexity yet, we make study plans according to, like, okay, you now know the test is 4 days away. So actually, and maybe I'll ask you this question, Seth. You've already learned it once, right? Hopefully, like you went to class, whatever, you already encoded it. But where on the study cycle do you begin if you're starting to actually prepare for a test?
Probably two.
Yeah, exactly. That's the most efficient way, is to test yourself to see what you know and you don't know, so that you know what's in the basket or the bucket. I love your bucket and water idea. And then once you know that, you can make your study plan for, it's like, oh, I'm going to have to make a plan to encode all these things in a new way. Usually I teach a process of honing your notes in a specific way that helps you encode creatively, and then test yourself to see what you learned and what you didn't. And so then you're bouncing back between 2-3, 2-3, 2-3, but starting with two is usually the most efficient way to do it.
All right, cool. And this is called what? What's this model?
I call this study cycle. And on my website, GretchenWegner.com, it's not quite ready as we're recording this, but it will be ready when people are watching. I have a new course that, you know, we've been talking for an hour and a half, but this course breaks down teaching the study cycle first to students. And then I provide some tips for parents, and then I provide some tips for educators and some shorter videos. And so people can go grab that. And then we have, through this telesummit, will be... there will be a handout that I haven't created yet because I wanted us to talk first to see what might need to be created. But I'll have a little written summary of the study cycle, including the visual image. All my whiteboards have this image on the back of them, and I give these to all of my clients. And so this image will be a part of the handout that people can download. So if people want to, like, put it on their refrigerator.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And were there any other whiteboards that you wanted to go over today?
No, that was the last one.
Okay. So let me do a couple more quick, very, very actionable, practical questions. Yeah. You have a parent watching, they have a middle schooler or a high schooler, maybe an elementary kid that's just starting to get into note taking. What's one of the most important things? People tend to think of note-taking as this very linear, step-by-step, copy what's on the board, dry process. What's one of the best note-taking tips these parents should know that they can convey to their kid?
Practice using visual symbols. And maybe even, just to make it simple, practice like bullets and arrows, so that kids aren't just writing down what the teacher is saying, but they're like seeing, like, oh, look, that idea is connected to this idea with the arrow. And I have a section on note-taking in the anti-boring approach online course, and we look at all kinds of tools for what I call honing your notes. But the brain is incredibly visual. Even if you don't think you're a visual learner, you're human, sorry to break it to you, the brain's visual. And all the studies show that connecting words to images really makes a difference. So in, like, truly highly advanced note-taking, you'd have a lot of images, shapes, visual symbols in your notes. But for the new note-taker, just practice, like, rather than just a line, like, practice bullets, like main bullet and then subheading bullet. And then practice arrows.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I teach kids to draw their notes and use four color pens and make it very visual because it works. Awesome. And then another one is when it comes to studying specifically for a test, What's one of the most important practical tips they can do with their kid to study?
Yeah, so what I would recommend is that every parent understand the study cycle. And I know we're creating a video to directly to students. And so I will likely, I haven't made it yet, but I will likely just reteach the study cycle, but to students in 5 minutes, you know, on the video. So it's nice and short. So parents, watch that video with your student. And then when it's time to study, ask your student, or even when they're doing homework, actually, let's not even make this about studying, because if you do it when they're doing homework, it's preparing to study. Get practiced at just asking your kid, where on the study cycle are you right now? Most of the time they won't know. Even if you're filling out a worksheet, cool, you can make a choice. Do I want to fill out the worksheet by testing myself first to see what I know and what I don't know, in which case I don't open the textbook yet? Or do I want to encode it in a new way by reading the textbook and then filling it out? And then ask my parent to quiz me afterwards to see what I know and what I don't know at the end. So just developing a consciousness. Where are you on the study cycle? And stop. Sorry, trash is here. I hope it's not too loud.
It's not.
Good. Developing a consciousness around what do I want? Oh, I lost. I found my thought now. Parents, stop asking, did you study? Or when are you going to study? Stop asking that question. Not a useful question. You're not communicating anything. Instead, ask a question like, hey, I know the test is coming up. Where on the study cycle do you need to be tonight? Oh, I need to figure out what's in my basket. I need to do initial testing to see what I have to study. Great. Perfect.
And I like that. And for highly linear parents, I can see this being challenging, because I can see them wanting to think that there is a right answer to that question.
Right.
But I noticed when you asked me where I thought things were, your response back to me was, sounds like a pretty good answer.
Yeah.
No matter what I said.
Right. And actually, I did get a clue the way you answered and the ideas you gave. Like if this were a coaching session and you were a student, I saw that, oh yeah, Seth does have a bunch of interesting encoding methods. That's wonderful. And I already heard the things that you're missing in your toolbox, by the way.
Right.
And so the coaching session, I would go there eventually with you to help add the tools that I heard you were missing. But
yeah,
I didn't need to mention that to you right now, because yay that you feel competent about something. Awesome.
But what you said was that the goal of this, and I just want to make clear for people who are looking for sort of the right answer or whatever, the goal wasn't to do that, but was to develop the consciousness around it. And I do that a lot in my practice. I'll ask these questions to kids, and I don't even necessarily care what the answer is. I care to develop the metacognition, the consciousness around the issue. And there's so much value.
Yeah. Awesome. Sorry. There's
no,
so much.
I just wanted to mention that. Just like parents, yeah, don't worry, you know, about necessarily where they're actually at. Them having the discussion, and you can then say, "Oh, and I think you're probably here too," or "Oh, okay, that sounds great," or "Tell me more," or
yeah.
We don't have to have these linear sort of ends and right answers to things. This is more about a process than the right answer.
And parents, you also can reflect about the study cycle. Like, oh my God, remember that study cycle thing that we saw that lady do on that summit? I was at work today and I decided to ask myself, where am I on the study cycle with this one thing? And I realized that actually I could be more efficient if I took a quick moment to test myself and like to make a list on what do I know and what don't I know before I write the report, than if I just sat in front of the computer and tried to write the report.
And just modeling that is so powerful on so many levels.
Yeah. And what I would love to see is something like the study cycle be a common language that teachers, parents, and students have, so that we build students' metacognitive abilities faster in terms of being able to watch what they're doing when they're learning and then being able to take action.
Now you've got, I may ask a couple more questions. These are just super practical. You've got a parent watching and they're like, okay, this all sounds great, but my kid won't task initiate. They won't start anyway. They procrastinate. They've got every excuse in the book. You know, if they're working with you, Gretchen, or a tutor, you know, they can do stuff. But when they're at home, they don't get anything done. How do I help them get started?
The quick answer would be have a family focused time after school between the hours of such and such and such and such. Everybody's focused. This idea of body doubling, of like we work better when there are other focused people around. So your distracted kid is not going to work as well if you're cooking and watching TV and doing something fun and somebody else's whatever, whatever, whatever. So just be like, okay, this is the time when we're having focused work happening in the house. I mean, that's not a magic bullet. A student might still be really distracted, but it'll make it a little easier to have other bodies again, right? Mm-hmm. The idea of bodies.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you have a student who is working either with you or the parents, or you know, they're trying to do their work and the kid's really distracted. What are some of the things you find yourself saying over and over about parents who are like, yeah, my kid's always distracted. They might start, but they keep getting off task.
Yeah, and that's when finding out like what's distracting you right now. I mean, if it were me, I would grab, where did I put my gears? I would grab the gears because all my clients know the gears. And so they would know there's tools, routine, team, and self-talk. And so I'd say, I notice you're really distracted. Which of the gears, like, where do you think you're, are you most distracted?
Go through that real quick. Or no, you don't have to.
I can. It's just, it can't, like, it's sort of like to do it thoroughly. It's like 15.
Now, how about not thoroughly, but a little more than.
Yeah, so you, like, do you have the right tools? Like, did you leave your textbook at home?
Okay, so tools is one.
Yeah. The routine is the other. Like, have you thought through, like I teach a setup routine to students. Like when you get home, set up your work first. Like if you're diving in to try and do your homework, if you don't set it up and think about the steps, not going to happen. So maybe they need to do this first.
Okay. And I use the words routine and habit more or less interchangeably. Do you as well?
No, because for me, a habit can be a single action that they're working on. Sometimes a habit is a routine, but for me, a routine is a set of behaviors that each behavior is doable by itself. Like, oh, I can open my planner. That's not a problem. Oh, I can look at the planner and fill in the things that are missing.
Okay, got it.
Does that make sense? Yep. And so it's a list of like 3 to 5 really doable things where you might feel overwhelmed if you're like, oh God, I got to do my homework. But you're not overwhelmed. Like, oh, I should do the setup routine. I can at least open my planner. Maybe that's all I'll do. Then you open your phone. Oh, okay. I can go ahead and make the list.
So you've got the tools and the routines and then
the routine, the team. And so that's about other bodies. Like, can you do it by yourself? Do you need to ask a friend to show up on FaceTime to do quiet homework with you? Do you need that family focus time? Do you actually not really understand what you need to do? And so you need to email your teacher. Some teachers will email you back pretty quickly. Some won't, but so how do you need to include other people?
The team. Okay. And then what was the last one? The
last one is the self-talk where you, is there a thought you're telling yourself that's really stressful, that's keeping you from focusing? Cause you're telling yourself like, oh, I can't do this one more. Like, oh, I just want to watch my TV show. I don't want to do it. Or, oh, I feel stupid or whatever it is.
Yeah. One of the things I say a lot is don't believe everything you think because we often just take the self-talk seriously as if it's a fact.
Yes.
It's just a thought. Awesome. Yes. This has been so great. Now I didn't expect to ask all those questions, but I have a real wrap-up question. And this is the final question. I have two more real questions. The first one is, what specific actions can parents take this coming week to implement some of your teachings? They can go to your site, they can download the cycle.
I would say the specific actions are to watch the study cycle video designed for the student. So it's just 5 minutes, but to watch it as a family, step one. Step two would be at a family meal later on, see if you can test yourselves to see as a family if you can recreate the study cycle and if you remember the steps. That's the second one. And then at another family meal the next day, test yourself again to see if you know the steps and play a little game to see if you can notice in your lives over the last day whether you did anything, whether you were encoding something for the first time or whether you were testing yourself, and just see if you can identify one of the steps at work.
Okay. So starting to build consciousness around this cycle so that you can start using this tool in a powerful way. Okay. And then the last question is this. Mm-hmm. From your heart to the parents that are watching right now, what is the most important takeaway you hope people will leave with of all?
Oh, it is so hard. Like, just be kind. Be kind to yourself. Parenting is so difficult, and parenting a student who is creative and neurodivergent is even harder in the kind of culture we have. And I know you probably have a lot of that negative self-talk in your head about, I'm doing it wrong. My actions are going to make or break my child's success and happiness and ability to be a loving presence in this world. I'm guessing you may be telling yourself that. And just give yourself a lot of love. Your kid is going to be okay. Every client I've ever worked with, because I track them too, they turned out good. They're okay. So be kind to yourself. Take a lot of deep breaths and really trust it's going to work out.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Gretchen. I really appreciate you.
Yeah, I appreciate you too, Seth. This has been fun. We achieved, I think, our goal of connecting and each learning something.
I think so. All right, everybody, go take action. Have a great day. We'll see you in the next one.